earlier bedtimes. The cause is an earlier evening release and peak of melatonin as we get older, instructing an earlier start time for sleep. Restaurants and retirement communities have long known of this age-related shift in bedtime preference, epitomized and accommodated by the early bird special. Changes in circadian rhythms with advancing age may appear harmless, but they can be the cause of numerous sleep and wake problems in the elderly. Older adults often want to stay awake later into the evening so that they can go to the theater or the movies, socialize, read, or watch television. But in doing so, they find themselves waking up on the couch, in a movie theater seat, or in a reclining chair, having inadvertently fallen asleep mid-evening. Their regressed circadian rhythm, instructed by an earlier release of melatonin, left them no choice. But what seems like an innocent doze has a damaging consequence. The early evening snooze will jettison precious sleep pressure, building away the sleepiness power of adenosine that had been steadily building throughout the day. Several hours later, when that older individual gets into bed and tries to fall asleep, they may not have enough sleep pressure to fall asleep quickly or stay asleep as easily. An erroneous conclusion follows. I have insomnia. Instead, dozing off in the evening, which most older adults do not realize is classified as napping, can be the source of sleep difficulty, not true insomnia. A compounding problem arrives in the morning. Despite having had trouble falling asleep that night, and already running a sleep debt, the circadian rhythm, which, as you'll remember from Chapter 2, operates independently of the sleep pressure system, will start to rise around 4 or 5 a.m. in many elderly individuals, enacting its classic earlier schedule in seniors. Older adults are therefore prone to wake up early in the morning as the alerting drumbeat of the circadian rhythm grows louder and corresponding hopes of returning back to sleep diminish in tandem. Making matters worse, the strengths of the circadian rhythm and amount of nighttime melatonin released also decrease the older we get. Add these things up, and a self-perpetuating cycle ensues, wherein many seniors are battling a sleep debt, trying to stay awake later in the evening, inadvertently dozing off earlier, finding it hard to fall or stay asleep at night, only to be woken up earlier than they wish because of a regressed circadian rhythm. There are methods that can help push the circadian rhythm in older adults somewhat later and also strengthen the rhythm. Here again, they are not a complete or perfect solution, I'm sad to say. Later chapters will describe the damaging influence of artificial light on the circadian 24-hour rhythm, bright light at night. Evening light suppresses the normal rise in melatonin, pushing an average adult sleep onset time into the early morning hours, preventing sleep at a reasonable hour. However, the same sleep-delaying effect can be put to good use in older adults if timed correctly. Having woken up early, many older adults are physically active during the morning hours and therefore obtain much of their bright light exposure in the first half of the day. This is not optimal, as it reinforces the early-to-rise, early-to-decline cycle of the 24-hour internal clock. Instead, older adults who want to shift their bedtimes to a later hour should get bright light exposure in the late afternoon hours. I am not, however, suggesting that older adults stop exercising in the morning. Exercise can help solidify good sleep, especially in the elderly. Instead, I advise two modifications for seniors. First, wear sunglasses during morning exercise outdoors. This will reduce the influence of morning light being sent to your suprachiasmatic clock that would otherwise keep you on an early-to-rise schedule. Second, go back outside in the late afternoon for sunlight exposure, but this time do not wear sunglasses. Make sure to wear sun protection of some sort, such as a hat, but leave the sunglasses at home. Plentiful later afternoon daylight will help delay the evening release of melatonin, helping push the timing of sleep to a later hour. Older adults may also wish to consult with their doctor about taking melatonin in the evening. Unlike young or middle-aged adults, where melatonin has not proved efficacious for helping sleep Beyond the circumstance of jet lag, prescription melatonin has been shown to help boost the otherwise blunted circadian and associated melatonin rhythm in the elderly, reducing the time taken to fall asleep and improving self-reported sleep quality and morning alertness. The change in circadian rhythm as we get older, together with more frequent trips to the bathroom, help to explain two of the three key nighttime issues in the elderly: early sleep onset offset and sleep fragmentation. They do not, however, explain the first key change in sleep with advancing age: the loss of deep sleep quantity and quality. Although scientists have known about the pernicious loss of deep sleep with advancing age for many decades, the cause has remained elusive. What is it about the aging process that so thoroughly robs the brain of this essential state of slumber? Beyond scientific curiosity, it is also a pressing clinical issue for the elderly, considering the importance of deep sleep for learning and memory, not to mention all branches of bodily health, from cardiovascular and respiratory to metabolic, energy balance, and immune function. Working with an incredibly gifted team of young researchers, I set out to try and answer this question several years ago. I wondered whether the cause of this sleep decline was to be found in the intricate pattern of structural brain deterioration that occurs as we age. You will recall from Chapter 3 that the powerful brain waves of deep NREM sleep are generated in the middle frontal regions of the brain, several inches above the bridge of your nose. We already knew that as individuals get older, their brains do not deteriorate uniformly. Instead, some parts of the brain start losing neurons much earlier and far faster than other parts of the brain, a process called atrophy. After performing hundreds of brain scans and amassing almost 1,000 hours of overnight sleep recordings, we discovered a clear answer, unfolding in a three-part story. First, the areas of the brain that suffer the most dramatic deterioration with aging are, unfortunately, the very same deep sleep-generating regions, the middle frontal regions seated above the bridge of the nose. When we overlaid the map of brain degeneration hotspots in the elderly on the brain map that highlighted the deep sleep-generating regions in young adults, there was a near-perfect match. Second, and unsurprisingly, older adults suffered a 70% loss of deep sleep compared with matched young individuals. Third, and most critical, we discovered that these changes were not independent, but instead significantly connected with one another. The more severe the deterioration that an older adult suffers within this specific mid-frontal region of their brain, the more dramatic their loss of deep NREM sleep. It was a saddening confirmation of my theory. The parts of our brain that ignite healthy deep sleep at night are the very same areas that degenerate, or atrophy, earliest and most severely as we age. In the years leading up to these investigations, my research team and several others around the world had demonstrated how critical deep sleep was for cementing new memories and retaining new facts in young adults. Knowing this, we had included a twist to our experiment in older adults. Several hours before going to sleep, all of these seniors learned a list of new facts, word associations, quickly followed by an immediate memory test to see how much information they had retained. The next morning, following the night of sleep recording, we tested them a second time. We could therefore determine the amount of memory savings that had occurred for any one individual across the night of sleep. The older adults forgot far more of the facts by the following morning than the young adults, a difference of almost 50%. Furthermore, those older adults with the greatest loss of deep sleep showed the most catastrophic overnight forgetting. Poor memory and poor sleep in old age are therefore not coincidental, but rather significantly interrelated. The findings helped to shed new light on the forgetfulness that is all too common in the elderly, such as difficulty remembering people's names or memorizing upcoming hospital appointments. It is important to note that the extent of brain deterioration in older adults explains 60% of their inability to generate deep sleep. This was a helpful finding. But the more important lesson to be gleaned from this discovery for me was that 40% of the explanation for the loss of deep sleep in the elderly remained unaccounted for by our discovery. We are now hard at work trying to discover what that is. Recently, we identified one factor, a sticky, toxic protein that builds up in the brain called beta-amyloid that is a key cause of Alzheimer's disease, a discovery discussed in the next several chapters. More generally, these and similar studies have confirmed that poor sleep is one of the most underappreciated factors contributing to cognitive and medical ill health in the elderly, including issues of diabetes, depression, chronic pain, stroke, cardiovascular disease, and Alzheimer's disease. An urgent need, therefore, exists for us to develop new methods that restore some quality of deep, stable sleep in the elderly. One promising example that we have been developing involves brain stimulation methods, including controlled electrical stimulation pulsed into the brain at night. Like a supporting choir to a flagging lead vocalist, our goal is to electrically sing, stimulate, in time with the ailing brainwaves of older adults, amplifying the quality of their deep brainwaves and salvaging the health and memory-promoting benefits of sleep. Our early results look cautiously promising, though much, much more work is required. With replication, our findings can further debunk the long-held belief that we touched on earlier. Older adults need less sleep. This myth has stemmed from certain observations that, to some scientists, suggest that an 80-year-old, say, simply needs less sleep than a 50-year-old. Their arguments are as follows. First, if you deprive older adults of sleep, they do not show as dramatic an impairment in performance on a basic response time task as a younger adult. Therefore, older adults must need sleep less than younger adults. Second, older adults generate less sleep than young adults, so by inference, older adults must simply need sleep less. Third, older adults do not show a stronger sleep rebound after a night of deprivation compared with young adults. The conclusion was that seniors therefore have less need for sleep if they have less of a recovery rebound. There are, however, alternative explanations. Using performance as a measure of sleep need is perilous in older adults, since older adults are already impaired in their reaction times to begin with. Said unkindly, older adults don't have much farther to fall in terms of getting worse, sometimes called a floor effect, making it difficult to estimate the real performance impact of sleep deprivation. Next, just because an older individual obtains less sleep, or does not obtain as much recovery sleep after sleep deprivation, does not necessarily mean that their need for sleep is less. It may just as easily indicate that they cannot physiologically generate the sleep they still nevertheless need. Take the alternative example of bone density, which is lower in older compared with younger adults. We do not assume that older individuals need weaker bones just because they have reduced bone density. Nor do we believe that older adults have bones that are weaker simply because they don't recover bone density and heal as quickly as young adults after suffering a fracture or break. Instead, we realize that their bones, like the centers of the brain that produce sleep, deteriorate with age, and we accept this degeneration as the cause of numerous health issues. We consequently provide dietary supplements, physical therapy, and medications to try to offset bone deficiency. I believe we should recognize and treat sleep impairments in the elderly with a similar regard and compassion, recognizing that they do, in fact, need just as much sleep as other adults. Finally, the preliminary results of our brain stimulation studies suggest that older adults may, in fact, need more sleep than they themselves can naturally generate, since they benefit from an improvement in sleep quality, albeit through artificial means. If older individuals did not need more deep sleep, then they should already be satiated and not benefit from receiving more, artificially in this case. Yet they do benefit from having their sleep enhanced, or perhaps worded correctly, restored. That is, older adults, and especially those with different forms of dementia, appear to suffer an unmet sleep need, which demands new treatment options. A topic that we shall soon return to. Part 2. Why should you sleep? Chapter 6. Your mother and Shakespeare knew. The benefits of sleep for the brain. Amazing breakthrough. Scientists have discovered a revolutionary new treatment that makes you live longer. It enhances your memory and makes you more creative. It makes you look more attractive. It keeps you slim and lowers food cravings. It protects you from cancer and dementia. It wards off colds and the flu. It lowers your risk of heart attacks and stroke, not to mention diabetes. You'll even feel happier, less depressed, and less anxious. Are you interested? While it may sound hyperbolic, nothing about this fictitious advertisement would be inaccurate. If it were for a new drug, many people would be disbelieving. Those who were convinced would pay large sums of money for even the smallest dose. Should clinical trials back up the claims, share prices of the pharmaceutical company that invented the drug would skyrocket. Of course, the ad is not describing some miracle new tincture or a cure-all wonder drug, but rather the proven benefits of a full night of sleep. The evidence supporting these claims has been documented in more than 17,000 well-scrutinized scientific reports to date. As for the prescription cost, well, there isn't one. It's free. Yet all too often, we shun the nightly invitation to receive our full dose of this all-natural remedy, with terrible consequences. Failed by the lack of public education, most of us do not realize how remarkable a panacea sleep truly is. The following three chapters are designed to help rectify our ignorance, born of this largely absent public health message. We will come to learn that sleep is the universal healthcare provider. Whatever the physical or mental ailment, sleep has a prescription it can dispense. Upon completion of these chapters, I hope even the most ardent of short sleepers will be swayed, having a reformed deference. Earlier, I described the component stages of sleep. Here, I reveal the attendant virtues of each. Ironically, most all of the new 21st century discoveries regarding sleep were delightfully summarized in 1611 in Macbeth, Act 2, Scene 2, where Shakespeare prophetically states that sleep is the chief nourisher in life's feast. Perhaps with less highfalutin language, your mother offered similar advice, extolling the benefits of sleep in healing emotional wounds, helping you learn and remember, gifting you with solutions to challenging problems, and preventing sickness and infection. Science, it seems, has simply been evidential, providing proof of everything your mother, and apparently Shakespeare, knew about the wonders of sleep. Sleep for the brain. Sleep is not the absence of wakefulness. It is far more than that. Described earlier, our nighttime sleep is an exquisitely complex, metabolically active, and deliberately ordered series of unique stages. Numerous functions of the brain are restored by, and depend upon, sleep. No one type of sleep accomplishes all. Each stage of sleep, light NREM sleep, deep NREM sleep, and REM sleep, offer different brain benefits at different times of the night. Thus, no one type of sleep is more essential than another. Losing out on any one of these types of sleep will cause brain impairment. Of the many advantages conferred by sleep on the brain, that of memory is especially impressive and particularly well understood. Sleep has proven itself time and again as a memory aid, both before learning, to prepare your brain for initially making new memories, and after learning, to cement those memories and prevent forgetting. Sleep the night before learning. Sleep before learning refreshes our ability to initially make new memories. It does so each and every night. While we are awake, the brain is constantly acquiring and absorbing novel information, intentionally or otherwise. Passing memory opportunities are captured by specific parts of the brain. For fact-based information, or what most of us think of as textbook-type learning, such as memorizing someone's name, a new phone number, or where you parked your car, a region of the brain called the hippocampus helps apprehend these passing experiences and binds their details together. A long finger-shaped structure, tucked deep on either side of your brain, the hippocampus offers a short-term reservoir, or temporary information store, for accumulating new memories. Unfortunately, the hippocampus has a limited storage capacity, almost like a camera roll, or, to use a more modern-day analogy, a USB memory stick. Exceed its capacity, and you run the risk of not being able to add more information, or, equally bad, overwriting one memory with another, a mishap called interference forgetting. How, then, does the brain deal with this memory capacity challenge? Some years ago, my research team wondered if sleep helped solve this storage problem by way of a file transfer mechanism. We examined whether sleep shifted recently acquired memories to a more permanent, long-term storage location in the brain, thereby freeing up our short-term memory stores so that we awake with a refreshed ability for new learning. We began testing this theory using daytime naps. We recruited a group of healthy young adults and randomly divided them into a nap group and a no-nap group. At noon, all the participants underwent a rigorous session of learning, 100 face name pairs, intended to tax the hippocampus, their short-term memory storage site. As expected, both groups performed at comparable levels. Soon after, the nap group took a 90-minute siesta in the sleep laboratory with electrodes placed on their heads to measure sleep. The no-nap group stayed awake in the laboratory and performed menial activities, such as browsing the internet or playing board games. Later that day, at 6 p.m., all participants performed another round of intensive learning, where they tried to cram yet another set of new facts into their short-term storage reservoirs, another 100 face name pairs. Our question was simple. Does the learning capacity of the human brain decline with continued time awake across the day? And, if so, can sleep reverse this saturation effect and thus restore learning ability? Those who were awake throughout the day became progressively worse at learning, even though their ability to concentrate remained stable, determined by separate attention and response time tests. In contrast, those who napped did markedly better and actually improved in their capacity to memorize facts. The difference between the two groups at 6 p.m. was not small, a 20% learning advantage for those who slept. Having observed that sleep restores the brain's capacity for learning, making room for new memories, we went in search of exactly what it was about sleep that transacted the restoration benefit. Analyzing the electrical brainwaves of those in the nap group brought our answer. The memory refreshment was related to lighter, stage 2 NREM sleep, and specifically the short, powerful bursts of electrical activity called sleep spindles, noted in Chapter 3. The more sleep spindles an individual obtained during the nap, the greater the restoration of their learning when they woke up. Importantly, sleep spindles did not predict someone's innate learning aptitude. That would be a less interesting result, as it would imply that inherent learning ability and spindles simply go hand in hand. Instead, it was specifically the change in learning from before relative to after sleep, which is to say the replenishment of learning ability, that spindles predicted. Perhaps more remarkable, as we analyzed the sleep spindle bursts of activity, we observed a strikingly reliable loop of electrical current pulsing throughout the brain that repeated every 100 to 200 milliseconds. The pulses kept weaving a path back and forth between the hippocampus, with its short-term limited storage space, and the far larger, long-term storage site of the cortex, analogous to a large memory hard drive. In that moment, we had just become privy to an electrical transaction occurring in the quiet secrecy of sleep, one that was shifting fact-based memories from the temporary storage depot, the hippocampus, to a long-term secure vault, the cortex. In doing so, sleep had delightfully cleared out the hippocampus, replenishing this short-term information repository with plentiful free space. Participants awoke with a refreshed capacity to absorb new information within the hippocampus, having relocated yesterday's imprinted experiences to a more permanent safe hold. The learning of new facts could begin again, anew, the following day. We and other research groups have since repeated this study across a full night of sleep and replicated the same finding. The more sleep spindles an individual has at night, the greater the restoration of overnight learning ability come the next morning. Our recent work on this topic has returned to the question of aging. We have found that seniors, aged 60 to 80 years old, are unable to generate sleep spindles to the same degree as young, healthy adults, suffering a 40% deficit. This led to a prediction. The fewer sleep spindles an older adult has on a particular night, the harder it should be for them to cram new facts into their hippocampus the next day, since they have not received as much overnight refreshment of short-term memory capacity. We conducted the study, and that is precisely what we found. The fewer the number of spindles an elderly brain produced on a particular night, the lower the learning capacity of that older individual the next day, making it more difficult for them to memorize the list of facts we presented. This sleep and learning link is yet one more reason for medicine to take more seriously the sleep complaints of the elderly, further compelling researchers such as myself to find new, non-pharmacological methods for improving sleep in aging populations worldwide. Of broader societal relevance, the concentration of NREM sleep spindles is especially rich in the late morning hours, sandwiched between long periods of REM sleep. Sleep 6 hours or less, and you are shortchanging the brain of a learning restoration benefit that is normally performed by sleep spindles. I will return to the broader educational ramifications of these findings in a later chapter, addressing the question of whether early school start times, which throttle precisely this spindle-rich phase of sleep, are optimal for the teaching of young minds. Sleep the night after learning. The second benefit of sleep for memory comes after learning, one that effectively clicks the save button on those newly created files. In doing so, sleep protects newly acquired information, affording immunity against forgetting, an operation called consolidation. That sleep sets in motion the process of memory consolidation was recognized long ago, and may be one of the oldest proposed functions of sleep. The first such claim in the written human record appears to be by the prophetic Roman rhetorician Quintilian, AD 35-100, who stated, "It is a curious fact, of which the reason is not obvious, that the interval of a single night will greatly increase the strength of the memory. Whatever the cause, things which could not be recalled on the spot are easily coordinated the next day, and time itself, which is generally accounted one of the causes of forgetfulness, actually serves to strengthen the memory." It was not until 1924, when two German researchers, John Jenkins and Karl Dallenbach, pitted sleep and wake against each other to see which one won out for a memory savings benefit, a memory researcher's version of the classic Coke versus Pepsi challenge. Their study participants first learned a list of verbal facts. Thereafter, the researchers tracked how quickly the participants forgot those memories over an 8-hour time interval, either spent awake or across a night of sleep. Time spent asleep helped cement the newly learned chunks of information, preventing them from fading away. In contrast, an equivalent time spent awake was deeply hazardous to recently acquired memories, resulting in an accelerated trajectory of forgetting. The experimental results of Jenkins and Dallenbach have now been replicated time and again, with a memory retention benefit of between 20% and 40% being offered by sleep, compared to the same amount of time awake. This is not a trivial concept when you consider the potential advantages in the context of studying for an exam, for instance, or evolutionarily in remembering survival-relevant information such as the sources of food and water, and locations of mates and predators. It was not until the 1950s, with the discovery of NREM and REM sleep, that we began to understand more about how, rather than simply if, sleep helps to solidify new memories. Initial efforts focused on deciphering what stages of sleep made immemorial that which we had imprinted onto the brain during the day, be it facts in the classroom, medical knowledge in a residency training program, or a business plan from a seminar. You will recall from Chapter 3 that we obtain most of our deep NREM sleep early in the night, and much of our REM sleep and lighter NREM sleep late in the night. After having learned lists of facts, researchers allowed participants the opportunity to sleep only for the first half of the night, or only for the second half of the night. In this way, both experimental groups obtained the same total amount of sleep, albeit short, yet the former group's sleep was rich in deep NREM, and the latter was dominated instead by REM. The stage was set for a battle royal between the two types of sleep. The question, which sleep period would confer a greater memory savings benefit, that filled with deep NREM, or that packed with abundant REM sleep? For fact-based, textbook-like memory, the result was clear. It was early night sleep, rich in deep NREM, that won out in terms of providing superior memory retention savings relative to late night, REM-rich sleep. Investigations in the early 2000s arrived at a similar conclusion, using a slightly different approach. Having learned a list of facts before bed, participants were allowed to sleep a full 8 hours, recorded with electrodes placed on the head. The next morning, participants performed a memory test. When researchers correlated the intervening sleep stages with the number of facts retained the following morning, deep NREM sleep carried the vote. The more deep NREM sleep, the more information an individual remembered the next day. Indeed, if you were a participant in such a study, and the only information I had was the amount of deep NREM sleep you had obtained that night, I could predict with high accuracy how much you would remember in the upcoming memory test upon awakening, even before you took it. That's how deterministic the link between sleep and memory consolidation can be. Using MRI scans, we have since looked deep into the brains of participants to see where those memories are being retrieved from before sleep relative to after sleep. It turns out that those information packets were being recalled from very different geographical locations within the brain at the two different times. Before having slept, participants were fetching memories from the short-term storage site of the hippocampus, that temporary warehouse, which is a vulnerable place to live for any long duration of time if you are a new memory. But things looked very different by the next morning. The memories had moved. After the full night of sleep, participants were now retrieving that same information from the neocortex, which sits at the top of the brain, a region that serves as the long-term storage site for fact-based memories, where they can now live safely, perhaps in perpetuity. We had observed a real estate transaction that takes place each night when we sleep. Fitting the notion of a long-wave radio signal that carries information across large geographical distances, the slow brainwaves of deep NREM had served as a courier service, transporting memory packets from a temporary storage hold, hippocampus, to a more secure, permanent home, the cortex. In doing so, sleep had helped future-proof those memories. Put these findings together with those I described earlier regarding initial memorization, and you realize that the anatomical dialogue established during NREM sleep, using sleep spindles and slow waves, between the hippocampus and cortex, is elegantly synergistic. By transferring memories of yesterday from the short-term repository of the hippocampus to the long-term home within the cortex, you awake with both yesterday's experiences safely filed away and having regained your short-term storage capacity for new learning throughout that following day. The cycle repeats each day and night, clearing out the cache of short-term memory for the new imprinting of facts while accumulating an ever-updated catalogue of past memories. Sleep is constantly modifying the information architecture of the brain at night. Even daytime naps as short as 20 minutes can offer a memory consolidation advantage, so long as they contain enough NREM sleep. Study infants, young kids, or adolescents, and you see the very same overnight memory benefit of NREM sleep, sometimes even more powerfully so. For those in midlife, 40 to 60 year olds, deep NREM sleep continues to help the brain retain new information in this way, with the decline in deep NREM sleep and the deterioration in the ability to learn and retain memories in old age having already been discussed. At every stage of human life, the relationship between NREM sleep and memory solidification is therefore observed. It's not just humans either. Studies in chimpanzees, bonobos, and orangutans have demonstrated that all three groups are better able to remember where food items have been placed in their environments by experimenters after they sleep. Descend down the phylogenetic chain to cats, rats, and even insects, and the memory-maintaining benefit of NREM sleep remains on powerful display. Though I still marvel at Quintilian's foresight and straightforward description of what scientists would, thousands of years later, prove true about sleep's benefit to memory, I prefer the words of two equally accomplished philosophers of their time, Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel. In February of 1964, they penned a now-famous set of lyrics that encapsulate the same nocturnal event in the song The Sound of Silence. Perhaps you know the song and lyrics. Simon and Garfunkel describe greeting their old friend, darkness, sleep. They speak of relaying the day's waking events to the sleeping brain at night in the form of a vision, softly creeping, a gentle information upload, if you will. Insightfully, they illustrate how those fragile seeds of waking experience, sown during the day, have now been embedded, planted, in the brain during sleep. As a result of that process, those experiences now remain upon awakening the next morning. Sleep's future-proofing of memories, all packaged for us in perfect song lyrics. A slight but important modification to Simon and Garfunkel's lyrics is warranted, based on very recent evidence. Not only does sleep maintain those memories you have successfully learned before bed, the vision that was planted in my brain still remains, but it will even salvage those that appear to have been lost soon after learning. In other words, following a night of sleep, you regain access to memories that you could not retrieve before sleep. Like a computer hard drive where some files have been corrupted and inaccessible, sleep offers a recovery service at night. Having repaired those memory items, rescuing them from the clutches of forgetting, you awake the next morning, able to locate and retrieve those once unavailable memory files with ease and precision. The "Ah yes, now I remember," sensation that you may have experienced after a good night of sleep. Having narrowed in on the type of sleep, NREM sleep, responsible for making fact-based memories permanent and further recovering those that were in jeopardy of being lost, we have begun exploring ways to experimentally boost the memory benefits of sleep. Success has come in two forms: sleep stimulation and targeted memory reactivation. The clinical ramifications of both will become clear when considered in the context of psychiatric illness and neurological disorders, including dementia. Since sleep is expressed in patterns of electrical brainwave activity, sleep stimulation approaches began by trading in the same currency, electricity. In 2006, a research team in Germany recruited a group of healthy young adults for a pioneering study in which they applied electrode pads onto the head, front and back. Rather than recording the electrical brainwaves being emitted from the brain during sleep, the scientists did the opposite: inserted small amounts of electrical voltage. They patiently waited until each participant had entered into the deepest stages of NREM sleep, and, at that point, switched on the brain stimulator, pulsing in rhythmic time with the slow waves. The electrical pulsations were so small that participants did not feel them, nor did they wake up. Footnote. This technique, called transcranial direct current brain stimulation, TDCS, should not be confused with electroconvulsive shock therapy, in which the size of electrical voltage inserted into the brain is many hundreds or thousands of times stronger, the consequences of which were so arrestingly illustrated in Jack Nicholson's performance in the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But they had a measurable impact on sleep. Both the size of the slow brainwaves and the number of sleep spindles riding on top of the deep brainwaves were increased by the stimulation, relative to a control group of subjects who did not receive stimulation during sleep. Before being put to bed, all the participants had learned a list of new facts. They were tested the next morning, after sleep. By boosting the electrical quality of deep sleep brainwave activity, the researchers almost doubled the number of facts that individuals were able to recall the following day, relative to those participants who received no stimulation. Applying stimulation during REM sleep, or during wakefulness across the day, did not offer similar memory advantages. Only stimulation during NREM sleep, in synchronous time with the brain's own slow mantra rhythm, leveraged a memory improvement. Other methods for amplifying the brainwaves of sleep are fast being developed. One technology involves quiet auditory tones being played over speakers next to the sleeper. Like a metronome in rhythmic stride with the individual's slow waves, the tick-tock tones are precisely synchronized with the individual's sleeping brainwaves to help entrain their rhythm and produce even deeper sleep. Relative to a control group that slept but had no synchronous auditory chimes at night, the auditory stimulation increased the power of the slow brainwaves and returned an impressive 40% memory enhancement the next morning. Before you drop this book and start installing speakers above your bed, or go shopping for an electrical brain stimulator, let me dissuade you. For both methods, the wisdom of "do not try this at home" applies. Some individuals have made their own brain-stimulating devices or bought such devices online, which are not covered by safety regulations. Skin burns and temporary losses of vision have been reported by mistakes in construction or voltage application. Playing loud TikTok acoustic tones on repeat next to your bed sounds like a safer option, but you may be doing more harm than good. When researchers in the above studies timed the auditory tones to strike just off the natural peak of each slow brainwave, rather than in perfect time with each brainwave, they disrupted, rather than enhanced, sleep quality. If brain stimulation or auditory tones were not bizarre enough, a Swiss research team recently suspended a bed frame on ropes from the ceiling of a sleep laboratory. Stick with me here. Affixed to one side of the suspended bed was a rotating pulley. It allowed the researchers to sway the bed from side to side at controlled speeds. Volunteers then took a nap in the bed as the researchers recorded their sleeping brainwaves. In half of the participants, the researchers gently rocked the bed once they entered NREM sleep. In the other half of the subjects, the bed remained static, offering a control condition. Slow rocking increased the depth of deep sleep, boosted the quality of slow brainwaves, and more than doubled the number of sleep spindles. It is not yet known whether these sway-induced sleep changes enhance memory, since the researchers did not perform any such tests with their participants. Nevertheless, the findings offer a scientific explanation for the ancient practice of rocking a child back and forth in one's arms, or in a crib, inducing a deep sleep. Sleep stimulation methods are promising, but they do have a potential limitation. The memory benefit they provide is indiscriminate. That is, all things learned before sleep are generally enhanced the next day. Similar to a pre-fix menu at a restaurant in which there are no options, you are going to get served all dishes listed, like it or not. Most people do not enjoy this type of food service, which is why most restaurants offer you a large menu from which you can pick and choose, selecting only those items you would like to receive. What if a similar opportunity was possible with sleep and memory? Before going to bed, you would review the learning experiences of the day, selecting only those memories from the menu list that you would like improved. You place your order, then go to sleep, knowing that your order will be served to you overnight. When you wake up in the morning, your brain will have been nourished only by the specific items you ordered from the autobiographical carte du jour. You have, as a consequence, selectively enhanced only those individual memories that you want to keep. It all sounds like the stuff of science fiction, but it is now science fact. The method is called targeted memory reactivation. And is so often the case, the true story turns out to be far more fascinating than the fictional one. Before going to sleep, we show participants individual pictures of objects at different spatial locations on a computer screen, such as a cat in the lower right side, or a bell in the upper center, or a kettle near the top right of the screen. As a participant, you have to remember not only the individual items you have been shown, but also their spatial location on the screen. You will be shown 100 of these items. After sleep, picture objects will again appear on the screen, now in the center, some of which you have seen before, some you have not. You have to decide if you remember the picture object or not, and if you do, you must move that picture object to the spatial location on the screen where it originally appeared, using a mouse. In this way, we can assess whether you remember the object and also how accurately you can remember its location. But here is the intriguing twist. As you were originally learning the images before sleep, each time an object was presented on the screen, a corresponding sound was played. For example, you would hear meow when the cat picture was shown, or ding-a-ling when the bell was shown. All picture objects are paired, or auditory tagged, with a semantically matching sound. When you are asleep, and in NREM sleep specifically, an experimenter will replay half of the previously tagged sounds, 50 of the total 100, to your sleeping brain, at low volume using speakers on either side of the bed. As if helping guide the brain in a targeted search and retrieve effort, we can trigger the selective reactivation of corresponding individual memories, prioritizing them for sleep strengthening, relative to those that were not reactivated during NREM sleep. When you are tested the following morning, you will have a quite remarkable bias in your recollection, remembering far more of the items that we reactivated during sleep using the sound cues than those not reactivated. Note that all 100 of the original memory items pass through sleep. However, using sound cueing, we avoid indiscriminate enhancement of all that you learned. Analogous to looping your favorite songs in a repeating playlist at night, we cherry-pick specific slices of your autobiographical past and preferentially strengthen them by using the individualized sound cues during sleep. Footnote: this nighttime reactivation method only works during NREM sleep and does not work if attempted during REM sleep. I'm sure you can imagine innumerable uses for such a method. That said, you may also feel ethically uncomfortable about the prospect, considering that you would have the power to write and rewrite your own remembered life narrative, or, more concerning, that of someone else. This moral dilemma is somewhat far in the future, but should such methods continue to be refined, it is one we may face. Sleep to forget. Up to this point, we have discussed the power of sleep after learning to enhance remembering and avoid forgetting. However, the capacity to forget can, in certain contexts, be as important as the need for remembering, both in day-to-day life, for example, forgetting last week's parking spot in preference for today's, and clinically, for example, in excising painful, disabling memories, or in extinguishing craving in addiction disorders. Moreover, forgetting is not just beneficial to delete stored information we no longer need. It also lowers the brain's resources required for retrieving those memories we want to retain, similar to the ease of finding important documents on a neatly organized, clutter-free desk. In this way, sleep helps you retain everything you need and nothing that you don't, improving the ease of memory recollection. Said another way, forgetting is the price we pay for remembering. In 1983, the Nobel laureate Francis Crick, who discovered the helical structure of DNA, decided to turn his theoretical mind toward the topic of sleep. He suggested that the function of REM sleep dreaming was to remove unwanted or overlapping copies of information in the brain, what he termed parasitic memories. It was a fascinating idea, but it remained just that, an idea, for almost 30 years, receiving no formal examination. In 2009, a young graduate student and I put the hypothesis to the test. The results brought more than a few surprises. We designed an experiment that again used daytime naps. At midday, our research subjects studied a long list of words presented one at a time on a computer screen. After each word had been presented on the screen, however, a large green R or a large red F was displayed, indicating to the participant that they should remember the prior word R or forget the prior word F. It is not dissimilar to being in a class, and, after having been told a fact, the teacher impresses upon you that it is especially important to remember that information for the exam, or instead that they made an error and the fact was incorrect, or the fact will not be tested on the exam, so you don't need to worry about remembering it for the test. We were effectively doing the same thing for each word right after learning, tagging it with the label, to be remembered, or to be forgotten. Half of the participants were then allowed a 90-minute afternoon nap, while the other half remained awake. At 6 p.m., we tested everyone's memory for all of the words. We told participants that regardless of the tag previously associated with a word, to be remembered or to be forgotten, they should try to recall as many words as possible. Our question was this: does sleep improve the retention of all words equally? Or does sleep obey the waking command only to remember some items while forgetting others, based on the tags we had connected to each? The results were clear. Sleep powerfully, yet very selectively, boosted the retention of those words previously tagged for remembering, yet actively avoided the strengthening of those memories tagged for forgetting. Participants who did not sleep showed no such impressive passing and differential saving of the memories. We had learned a subtle but important lesson. Sleep was far more intelligent than we had once imagined. Counter to earlier assumptions in the 20th and 21st centuries, sleep does not offer a general, non-specific, and hence verbose, preservation of all the information you learn during the day. Instead, sleep is able to offer a far more discerning hand in memory improvement, one that preferentially picks and chooses what information is and is not ultimately strengthened. Sleep accomplishes this by using meaningful tags that have been hung onto those memories during initial learning, or potentially identified during sleep itself. Numerous studies have shown a similarly intelligent form of sleep-dependent memory selection across both daytime naps and a full night of sleep. When we analyzed the sleep records of those individuals who napped, we gained another insight. Contrary to Francis Crick's prediction, it was not REM sleep that was sifting through the list of prior words, separating out those that should be retained and those that should be removed. Rather, it was NREM sleep, and especially the very quickest of the sleep spindles that helped bend apart the curves of remembering and forgetting. The more of those spindles a participant had during a nap, the greater the efficiency with which they strengthened items tagged for remembering and actively eliminated those designated for forgetting. Exactly how sleep spindles accomplish this clever memory trick remains unclear. What we have at least discovered is a rather telling pattern of looping activity in the brain that coincides with these speedy sleep spindles. The activity circles between the memory storage site, the hippocampus, and those regions that program the decision of intentionality in the frontal lobe, such as this is important or this is irrelevant. The recursive cycle of activity between these two areas, memory and intentionality, which happens 10 to 15 times per second during the spindles, may help explain NREM sleep's discerning memory influence. Much like selecting intentional filters on an internet search or a shopping app, spindles offer a refining benefit to memory by allowing the storage site of your hippocampus to check in with the intentional filters carried in your astute frontal lobes, allowing selection only of that which you need to save, while discarding that which you do not. We are now exploring ways of harnessing this remarkably intelligent service of selective remembering and forgetting with painful or problematic memories. The idea may invoke the premise of the Oscar-winning movie Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, in which individuals can have unwanted memories deleted by a special brain-scanning machine. In contrast, my real-world hope is to develop accurate methods for selectively weakening or erasing certain memories from an individual's memory library when there is a confirmed clinical need, such as in trauma, drug addiction, or substance abuse. Sleep for other types of memory. All of the studies I have described so far deal with one type of memory, that for facts, which we associate with textbooks or remembering someone's name. There are, however, many other types of memory within the brain, including skill memory. Take riding a bike, for example. As a child, your parents did not give you a textbook called How to Ride a Bike, ask you to study it, and then expect you to immediately begin riding your bike with skilled aplomb. Nobody can tell you how to ride a bike. Well, they can try, but it will do them, and more importantly, you, no good. You can only learn how to ride a bike by doing rather than reading, which is to say by practicing. The same is true for all motor skills, whether you are learning a musical instrument, an athletic sport, a surgical procedure, or how to fly a plane. The term muscle memory is a misnomer. Muscles themselves have no such memory. A muscle that is not connected to a brain cannot perform any skilled actions, nor does a muscle store skilled routines. Muscle memory is, in fact, brain memory. Training and strengthening muscles can help you better execute a skilled memory routine, but the routine itself, the memory program, resides firmly and exclusively within the brain. Years before I explored the effects of sleep on fact-based textbook learning, I examined motor skill memory. Two experiences shaped my decision to perform these studies. The first was given to me as a young student at the Queen's Medical Center, a large teaching hospital in Nottingham, England. Here, I performed research on the topic of movement disorders, specifically spinal cord injury. I was trying to discover ways of reconnecting spinal cords that had been severed, with the ultimate goal of reuniting the brain with the body. Sadly, my research was a failure. But during that time, I learned about patients with varied forms of motor disorders, including stroke. What struck me about so many of these patients was an iterative, step-by-step recovery of their motor function after the stroke, be it legs, arms, fingers, or speech. Rarely was the recovery complete, but day by day, month by month, they all showed some improvement. The second transformative experience happened some years later, while I was obtaining my PhD. It was 2000, and the scientific community had proclaimed that the next 10 years would be the decade of the brain, forecasting, accurately as it turned out, what would be remarkable progress within the neurosciences. I had been asked to give a public lecture on the topic of sleep at a celebratory event. At the time, we still knew relatively little about the effects of sleep on memory, though I made brief mention of the embryonic findings that were available. After my lecture, a distinguished-looking gentleman with a kindly affect, dressed in a tweed suit jacket with a subtle yellow-green hue that I still vividly recall to this day, approached me. It was a brief conversation, but one of the most scientifically important of my life. He thanked me for the presentation and told me that he was a pianist. He said he was intrigued by my description of sleep as an active brain state, one in which we may review and even strengthen those things we have previously learned. Then came a comment that would leave me reeling and trigger a major focus of my research for years to come. As a pianist, he said, I have an experience that seems far too frequent to be chance. I will be practicing a particular piece, even late into the evening, and I cannot seem